History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. Sometimes all it takes is a willingness to ask a few questions and then patiently listen as memories from long ago start making their way to the surface. Our aim here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really are inspired by these stories from those who put their lives on the line for us so many years ago. If you're a regular Hometown Heroes listener, you know the veterans we hear from on this program have been almost exclusively from the World War II generation. And people ask me a lot, when are we going to move on to veterans from later wars? And while we're still intent on capturing as many World War II stories as we can before it's too late, there are other veterans, lots of other veterans, with very compelling experiences to relate. And we're going to get a taste of one of those today from a man whose decorations include 3 Purple Hearts, the Distinguished Flying Cross, and even the Silver Star. He spent 29 years serving our country and is very active in a group called VUMS, Veterans of Underage Military Service. We've heard from a few here over the years who lied about their age to get involved in World War II, and here's someone who did the same thing a few years later during the Korean War. John D. Hosey is our guest today. His home in Woodinville, Washington is adorned with amazing artwork produced by his wife of 66 years, Sandy, but they never would have met if John hadn't changed his birth certificate to get into the Army at age 16. I want to start even earlier than that. Let's go back, John, to your childhood. What do you remember about those growing up years?
Well, it was a whole lot different than it is today. I grew up, I guess you could say, in all kind of states. I was a country boy. I was born in Birmingham, Alabama. My parents separated whenever I was between 10 and 11 years old. And my dad was a welder for Ingalls Shipyard. During the war, he was in charge of 360 women welders. One of them turned out to be my stepmother. Dad had about 3 jobs that was considered pretty good jobs. He also owned a honky-tonk back then, we called them, the Miss Alla Club between Alabama and Mississippi. We had a little bit of everything there. We had slot machines, we had dance hall, we had cottages around back. But my biggest and greatest memories was on the farm in Cullman, Alabama. I think we were 6 miles north of Cullman, and Dad owned a 1,300-acre farm there. We raised cotton, corn, and we did what we call a truck farm back then. We would load the truck up with stuff that we grew and take it into Birmingham and sell it right off the back of the truck. Then Mom and Dad were contract welders at that time, so they would be called off the farm and they would go different places. I know he went to Ohio a lot for contract welding up there, and I lived in Lorain, Ohio, right on the lake in a travel trailer for a while with them. One time, I just turned 16, I saw a sign that said that they wanted you to join the service. Well, I found out you had to be 17 to join the service, and I tricked my oldest brother into signing my paper. And I called him from Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and I said, "Amos, I won't be coming home today." And he says, "What do you mean you won't be coming home?" And I said, "You know those papers you signed last night?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm in the Army. I'm at Fort Jackson going to boot camp tomorrow." Silence on the phone. Total silence. After a few seconds, I said, Amos, you still there?" The next thing I heard was, "Good God, J.D., the old man will kill both of us." And that's how my military career started there.
So how did your father react to that news?
Well, I guess I had been in boot camp about a month. I got a call to come to the orderly room. And whenever I got to the orderly room, I saw a car sitting in front of it, and it was my mom and dad. Before I got inside, he stopped me, and he asked me, he says, "What in the world made you do what you did? Why did you go off and join the service? Your mom's heartbroken." I said, "Dad, I just didn't want to go to school anymore, and I didn't want to be on the farm anymore." He says, "Well, I can get you out." I says, "No, because then I'd get in trouble for fraudulent in the military." He says, "Well, go talk to your mother." I went over to the car, and Mom was sitting there crying. Me in an Army uniform walking up to the car, I guess, really set her off. I told her not to cry, that I was doing okay, and that I liked what I was doing. She didn't talk very much. She just cried most of the time that I was there with her.
Well, and it wasn't just your brother signing it. You had to fudge it a little bit, too. And driving up to your home here in Woodinville, Washington, I saw the flag for the VUMS, the Veterans of Underage Military Service, and you're one of them. So you were 16. What did you do to your papers to pretend that you were older?
It was very easy to take just a wee bit of Clorox and change a 5 to a 2. So I took that, and I changed on my birth certificate the 5 and made a 2 out of it. And if you just glanced at it, you couldn't tell the difference. So I was 32, which that was my brother, instead of 35.
So you were 16 pretending to be 19.
Right.
Did people buy it? Did the recruiter buy it?
Well, let's put it this way. I don't know that they really bought it, but if a 12-year-old can actually get in the service and pass his physical and all, I was able to. And a lot of people along the way might have realized how old I was, because I was still, well, let's say I was right at that age where I could be in the service when I wound up getting orders for Korea. And by then I had finished boot camp, I had finished airborne training, and I was in the middle of becoming an MP. So I had worked hard for where I was, and I think most of the people that saw me knew that I was worth maybe keeping in. I made it through everything okay, and wound up in Korea with the 187th Airborne. When I first hit Korea, they were moving pretty fast, so they asked, I guess this is one reason they say never volunteer for anything in the military. When I got off the ship, well, I guess I'm missing some of it. I don't know if you want me to bring in how I met my wife in this right now, or wait.
Well, that would be an important detail, but let me take you back even a little further, because I'm curious, and most of the people that I interview on this program served in World War II. You couldn't tell that big a lie. You were way too young to get into World War II.
Right.
But did what you saw, what you experienced as a boy during World War II and seeing so many others go off to war and come home, how did that affect you? How did that shape your perspective? And did that have anything to do with your desire to enlist?
You know, Paul, it may have, because back then, most of us that joined underage joined for a couple of three reasons. And one of those, we were darn patriotic, something that we don't have today. We either was really patriotic, we were poor and wanted to supplement our family, like Audie Murphy. Audie Murphy's family was really poor, and his sister signed his papers. But if we were patriotic, we would join. If we were poor, we joined. And some of us was in trouble. Now, I was not one of them that was in trouble, but some of the VUMs were in trouble with the police around their hometown and stuff. And they joined to get away from home and get away from their trouble. And a lot of them that was trouble kids, they made it and became really good military guys. Mm-hmm. I saw some of them come up through the ranks, and without them there by your side, you probably wouldn't have made it either. But the patriotism back then was really high, and I think my part of it was more patriotism than being poor, because I can't say that we were ever really in the poor category. My dad taught me that you give a man 8 hours of work for 8 hours of pay, and you will never be without a job. And I've never been without a job. If I've wanted a job, I've always had one.
I believe it. And you did mention your wife, and I believe it. And you did mention your wife, and chronologically, maybe it is a good time to work that in, because it sounds like when you met her, you were acting like a teenager, or like a lot of teenage boys do. It sounds like you were kind of obnoxious.
Well, she called me an obnoxious paratrooper, is what she called me. But we were both on the Greyhound bus between Salt Lake City and Seattle. I was coming up here to ship out to Korea, and she was coming up to study music and drama at the Cornish School of Music. And when I saw her get on the bus, I made a remark to another military guy with me, and I said, "Wow, that is one good-looking redhead." And I said, "I wouldn't mind meeting her." And he says, "Ah, she wouldn't give you a second glance." And I said, "Would you like to bet a dinner on that?" He said, "Yeah." So I made it a point at this time to actually meet her and get acquainted with her. I wound up in a seat across from her. She tried to go to sleep, and she put her feet up on the seat and out into the aisle of the bus. The temptation was there. So I scratched the bottom of her feet. And boy, she ticklish on her feet. She jerked her feet back, and she says, "What do you think you're doing?" Mm-hmm. I joked with her for a minute, and then she went back to sleep, I guess. And I started to read a comic book. After, I guess, maybe an hour, she woke up and looked across the seat at me, and she said, "Some people never grow up." So I said, "Oh, you're awake." And I got up and moved over in the double seat with her. And I started talking to her and everything. And next thing I knew, she had fallen asleep on my shoulder. It was real tempting. So I kissed her on the nose. And she woke up and she says, "Isn't the bus going fast enough for you?"
You know, you could get arrested for some of that today.
Well, when we got to Seattle and got off the bus, she was mighty happy that I was with her, because I think I either walked her or got a taxi, and we went to the YWCA where she had a reservation to stay for a few days. I asked her if I could take her to dinner, and she agreed, so I took her to dinner, and that started it. When I checked in at Lawton, up where it is no longer, when I checked in there, they told me that my ship wouldn't be leaving for 10 days to 2 weeks. So I called her, got in touch with her, and told her that I'd be around for a while. So we dated almost every night that I was here in Seattle. And then she went down to the ship, docked at Pier 91 to see me off, and she promised she'd write to me. And she and I wrote for the 13 months that I was gone in Korea, and then she also rode a few times after I got back home here. I went to Mississippi and stayed for 3 months, and then I came back up here. I got up here on Memorial Weekend of 54, and then in June of 55, we got married.
But you had to survive those 13 months in Korea in order to do that. Was there ever a time, or maybe even when you said goodbye to her at Pier 91, was there any thought in your head that you might not see her again?
You know, I don't think I ever thought about dying. I think that somewheres in the back of my mind, I probably thought I could do anything and make it through after going through boot camp and airborne training and all. I guess I was one of those kids that thought that he could live through almost anything. I've been told a few times that, in a way, that's what makes a hero. But to me, my heroes, Paul, are the ones that didn't come back. Mm-hmm. Those are the true heroes. I had a few friends that didn't come back. You miss them for a while, but then you have to think, you know, I've got a job to do, and you can't dwell on what happened yesterday. So you just go on and do what you have to do.
And we're going to learn more about what he had to do when we come back. John Hosey of Woodinville, Washington is our guest today, decorated veteran of the Korean War and the Vietnam War. Remember when he said you never volunteer for anything in the military? We're going to find out why he said that and hear his closest calls from Korea when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.